Today's tape will be on case 41. Today's tape show will be on case 41 in the Wumongkan, the U Mengkuan, Bodhidharma's mind pacifying. Bodhidharma sat facing the wall. The second patriarch stood in the snow. He cut off his arm and presented it to Bodhidharma, crying, "My mind has no peace yet. I beg you, Master, please pacify my mind." "Bring your mind here and I will pacify it for you," replied Bodhidharma. The second patriarch said, "I have searched for my mind and I cannot take hold of it." Bodhidharma said, "Now your mind is pacified." Mumon's comment, that broken-toothed old Hindu, came so importantly, thousands of miles over the sea. This was raising waves where there was no wind. In his last years, he induced enlightenment in his disciple, who, to make matters worse, was defective in the six roots. Why, Shasanru did not know even four ideographs. Mumon's verse, "Coming east, pointing directly, you entrusted the Dharma and trouble arose. The clamor of the monasteries is all because of you." I should just remind you that Mumon's comment is whenever Mumon means to compliment somebody, he seems to insult him. Okay. So when he says that Bodhidharma was that broken-toothed old Hindu, he's saying he was truly a great person, and all the people who train in the Zen tradition are infinitely in his debt. The Zen style is the Zen style is to pay people these strange kinds of compliments. You know? when somebody in our group does something like pass a koan or make great headway, you know, this is an American culture or modern culture. And so I go out of my way to say, you know, that's wonderful. And I mean it, because it is. It's wonderful. But the old style in Zen generally was like Master Mumon's style. When we would pass a koan with Genki Roshi, he would never go, "Oh, that is wonderful. That's a wonderful answer. Well done." He'd go, "Well, I don't know. I suppose, why don't I give you another koan, see if you can do better with this, you know." You know, this is actually quite an interesting approach, because it's saying don't hold on to don't hold on to that experience, you know. Move on to the next experience, you know. So there's a kind of greater compassion in this sort of strange style. In a way, Mumon is saying, don't try to be Bodhidharma, wake up yourself. Don't try to be Bodhidharma, wake up yourself. Don't make too much out of Bodhidharma, but on the other hand, we all owe him a lot. So I just wanted to get that off the table. Okay, so the main story is a very famous part of the Bodhidharma story. Bodhidharma was a monk who belonged to a particular school in India known as the Dhyana school. And Dhyana is often translated as meditation. But actually, this is a misunderstanding. All the schools of Buddhism are meditation schools, so there wouldn't be any point in calling one particular school the meditation school. The Dhyana school, which became Chan in China and Zen in Japan, taught a kind of meditation practice based on fusion or non-duality. Non-dual is one with the trusting mind. So as long as we are separate from the world, there's something wrong with our perception. As long as we entertain the idea of a separation from everything around us, from people and from things, our views are upside down, are distorted. And so the meditation we practice is, you could say, fusion meditation. So we become one with the breath. We become one with mu. We become one with the koans. See? And the koans allow us to become one with the moment. And that when that state of oneness is most fully realized, this is awakening. And that each stage along the way is an awakening experience. Each time the barrier between ourselves and other people, or ourselves and the world drops down, we experience awakening. Everything is one life. Everything is one life. It's an arbitrary belief to think that my life is different from your life, my life is separate from the world. I mean, intellectually, we know that things have to be interconnected. But the way we live does not always show that we believe it in our hearts. And so humans are very divided creatures, very divided in many different ways. And Zen is the path to returning home to that fundamental unity. In fact, the word sesshin means to unify the mind, unify the heart. You could say unify the mind with what? Unify the heart with what? So what's getting unified here? And that's a very interesting question, because implicit in the term sesshin is the idea that, you know, we become very divided people living in this world of human culture. And when we come to sesshin, it's possible to reunite with the what. One way to think about what we're doing at a sesshin is that we're trying to achieve enlightenment. You know, so we come in at day one and we sit on the cushion and we work like the devil, and we may or may not leave here having achieved quote unquote enlightenment, right? And you may go through many sesshins leaving with a sense of disappointment, if that's what you're aiming at. But another way of understanding sesshin is not that we are trying to encounter enlightenment, but that we are already listening to the voice of our enlightened selves. One way of thinking about sesshin is that we're trying to encounter our true nature. But another way of thinking about sesshin is that our true nature told us to come here. And all this time we have been manifesting our true nature. You know, earlier I mentioned that somebody had come to sesshin unexpectedly and said, you know, I wasn't planning to be here, but something just told me to come today, to come here today. So I got in my car and I came. You know, now, little mind might not know why it does things like that. And all during sesshin, little mind may be saying, I'm out of here, man. You know, this is really tough. But the odd thing is, you know, you didn't leave. You know, see, that's an odd thing. There's like one voice saying, this is too much. You know, this is too much. But then somehow you came. And somehow you didn't leave. Something held you here, and something brought you here. And that is enlightenment itself. So, you know, already there's a part of you, the center of you, the big mind, said, go to sesshin. Go to sesshin. And what you're doing at sesshin is carrying out the instructions of big mind. This is, I think, a much better way of thinking about what we're doing. much better way of thinking about what we're doing. You know, we're manifesting our enlightenment in sitting on the cushion hour after hour, day after day. And, you know, then the problem is that we just get in our own way. You know, we just get in our own way with the kind of divided consciousness that everybody has. But it's a different way of looking at Sesshin. You know, you should feel, no matter whether you've answered your koan or not, you know, that's not the point. What's most important is that you were true to your true self. That you were true to your... This, I think, is the essence of Zen, is being true to your true self. See? I mean, sometimes you do things that don't make too much sense to other people. My own family, when I got into Zen, they thought this was some kind of a cult. In fact, there's somebody sitting here who told me he thought that this was some kind of a cult when he first got started. And my parents, I really thought they were going to call, like, Cult Watch or something, you know. Really, and then I said, no, you know, Mom, you know, Professor Webb is the head of the art history department, you know, Genki Roshi's from a Japanese temple, you know, we get enough to eat, you know. We don't get that much sleep, that's true, that part of it is true, but... Yeah, but she, really, and I think they were, my parents were worried about it. They didn't understand this, and other people I've known didn't understand this, you know. But it was just something I had to do, you know. I had to do this. It was something, you know, it's this, life is so strange, you know. I had other plans in my life. And then I ran into Zen, and it just lit my heart, you know, on fire. You know, I just thought, what is this? You know, and it's going to sound strange, but you know, the day of my wedding, they had to come and get me because I was sitting in this room reading this book on Zen. I just couldn't put it down. I thought, wow, this is so amazing, you know? I just couldn't put it down. It's like, oh yeah, I've got to go get married. And by the way, I love my wife and I've been married for 30 years, you know? But man, this Zen, you know, I just love it. And then, you know, when I ran into Genki Roshi, it was just like, all, you know, all, I had read this book by Lu Kuan Yew. Charles Luck is how it, and the book is Chan and Zen Teaching, Volume 1. And it was about Xu Yun, great Xu Yun. And when I read this book, I just thought, this is my path. You know? And then I met Genki Roshi, and I went to Sesshin. And I'll tell you, that was murder. Murder. You know, I had read about this stuff, you know. I thought Zen masters, you know, you come into the Zendo, you put your shoes on your head, you go, katsu, you know, or something like that. You know, who knows, you know, there'd be just levitation or, you know. I mean, I had a kind of an idea because I read these beautiful teishos by Xu Yun that are in Chan and Zen teaching and just thought, this is fantastic. But, you know, I didn't know about the pain part, you know. Nobody told me about, I liked the enlightenment part, but I didn't like the pain part, you know. So, you know, I came to my first sesshin and I had only been sitting formally for a little while, you know, and a very lovely lady named Wendy Nakao was in our, she's now the abbot of the Los Angeles Zen Center, but she asked me if I wanted to go. She was signing people up for sesshin, and she had this beautiful smiling face and these bright eyes, and she said, would you like to go to sesshin? I said, yes, sign me up. And then, you know, next thing I know, there's a couple people here at this sesshin who are at their first sesshins, and they have done so well. It's amazing to me. And I'm frankly envious, you know. It's like, wow, I don't know. You know, when I was at my first sesshin, you know, you would think Dokusan would be a relief, right? Because you could get up, but just getting up was like, I don't know if I can get up, you know? And I can remember just sort of like crawling into the Dokusan room. It was just like, you know, I really did imagine, you know, I mean, it was just mind-numbing pain, you know? It was just unbearable. And yet, you know, I had these experiences during the Sesshin where, you know, I'd be in mind-numbing pain, and then I'd go on my way to the washroom, I'd look and see the trees and just feel so connected to those trees. It was like, those are the most beautiful trees I've ever seen, you know. And I remember there was a place where, like this place, where we used to do Sesshin at that time, was like a summer camp for kids on the Hood Canal. And there was this big giant sink. I guess everybody's supposed to stand around. It was a circular sink made of zinc. And everybody's supposed to stand around it. And you could have like 50 kids there all washing their faces and scrubbing their teeth. I guess that's the idea, all at once. And I was walking by this thing, and it was night, and the light was on, and the light was shining on the surface of the metal, and it was just, my heart was just breaking. It was just so beautiful. My heart was breaking. You know, and so, you know, Zen was like this bittersweet thing, because I was in a lot of pain, but then I had these achingly beautiful experiences, you know. And I just felt better. I just felt more alive, you know. And when it was over, you know, I couldn't even remember the pain. You know, the pain was gone. I just remembered these incredible moments of feeling so alive. And so it's a real joy. And I think this comes from being true to your true self. You know, I have friends. My sister-in-law is an artist. And in the living room of our house, there's a painting she did of a goose. When we used to have Sesshin there, you may remember the painting. But it's very beautiful painting. She did these paintings. For a while, she painted animals, and she painted these geese. And they're very beautiful paintings. And she gave us one because we admired it, and she was kind enough to give it to us. And, you know, her name is Sydney. Sydney has had a rough life, you know, because she is truly a great artist who has never been recognized. You know, and you know, it's so hard to sell your work. You know, you do stuff that's really wonderful, but it might just not be the kind of thing people want to hang in their living rooms, you know. So when people buy art, they might not think, I'm looking for something that has deep meaning. They want something blue that will go with their sofa, you know. So, you know, it's very hard to be an artist, you know. And so, you know, Sydney has had a rough life. I mean, you know, she has a job now and works. She went to school, went back to school, and has a degree in psychology, and she works in a halfway house, which is a very tough job. I mean, she works with juvenile delinquents, and you know, she still does her art, but, you know, she had many, when she was trying to make it, she had many lean years, many, you know, really rough years. And yet, you know, she's often said, I wouldn't change a thing, because she was living, you know, she was following her true nature. You know, something told her, you have got to paint, you know, and something told you, you have got to come here. And so, you know, a lot of the struggle in Zen, actually, is a struggle with our little selves. It's the struggle with our little selves. You know, we're not really struggling with our pain. We're not really, even though it seems like that. You know, it's really it's the struggle between being true to your true nature and you know, basically living in the little self. You know, if you come to Sesshin and you just say, this is my fate. You know, this is my true self has chosen this. This is my fate. You know, you can go through, I think, the pain with a lot clearer conscience and a lighter heart. You know, there is a lot of pain in sitting, but you know, it's kind of a mental game, actually, to make too much out of it. You know, part of it is just that you have nothing else to occupy your mind, and it gets magnified. So, you know, if I came along and with a cigarette while you were sitting and put it on your, you know, leg, you would go through the ceiling, and that would be pain, right? So, you know, the pain you feel in your knee is very slight pain. It's just muscle fatigue. But you have nothing else to occupy your consciousness except the muscle fatigue. And it becomes magnified in your mind. I mean, I hope I don't drive anybody crazy, but you're sitting there and it feels like your knee joint is being torn out of its socket, right? You can just picture the bleeding stump, right? Or the the snapped tendons, you know, under the flesh, right? You know. And it's like, my God, and then the bell rings, and you take your leg, and it's, oh my God, it's normal. You know, everything's like, this is like a mental game, you know. So, of course, dealing with pain is part of the game in this practice. But, realize that your true self put you here, and it's just something you have to deal with, and it's like every path has a price. This is sort of the price, and try to be lighthearted about it. You know, try to make not too much out of it, because it's not a big deal. As I always say, the Buddha had pain in his legs. The Dalai Lama has pain in his legs. They all started just the way. All of us started with pain in our legs, and at some point you get a little maturity about it. You know, you just realize, well, it's just pain. You know, mostly, I think we're afraid of pain. The thing is the fear, right? It's like, and that may be because actually, I mean, sometimes we have complex psychological responses to pain. So my experience is that, like, some people are used to pain, so they're like, I think what helped me with meditation was the fact that I used to be a runner and a swimmer. And if you're a runner, you know, you have to go, if you're, you know, you have physical pain, but you keep going. Or swimming too. You get cramps, you just have to keep going. You swim through your cramps, and you learn not to panic. It's like, this is, you know, I'll be okay. I can swim this cramp out, you know. Also, you know, if you're a hiker, you're used to your sore muscles. You know, you're going to start hiking with sore muscles. They're killing you, and then you start walking a few miles, and it goes away, and it's like amazing. You know, they're just a little you know, stiff, but the stiffness goes away, and you're okay. So I think some people, you know, have learned to live with pain. A lot of time, athletes, you know, and that helps a lot. But some people have had pain inflicted on them by people who frightened them. And in that case, pain is terrifying. So for example, some people have had parents who harshly discipline them with a corporal punishment. And then, you know, pain in your legs is just terrifying. It's terrifying. Or pain may be associated with a loss of control. See, I mean, if you're a very nervous person and your control is very important to you, when you begin to feel pain, that what you're really not afraid of is the pain. I think it's losing control. You know, so there, people have complex motives for their interaction with pain, but you know, all I can say is just keep going. You know, just don't make too much out of it. It's really not a big deal. You can become obsessive. And, you know, it is important to try to use mu or use your breath to sweep away your pain. But basically, you know, it may be many sesshins before you're successful. You know, you may have come into the Zendo this morning saying, this is it. I'm not going to move. Darn it, never again. You know? And then, you know, 20 minutes into the first sit, you know, I'm going to move. And, you know, all I can say is, you know, first of all, I don't think less of you if you move, you know, because I've been there. And this is, if you want to walk the path of Zen, this is something you've got to deal with. Sooner or later, you've got to be able to sit through the pain. And it will help you enormously to deepen your concentration. If we had no pain, we would be incapable, really, of entering deeper levels of concentration. Even though it doesn't seem very credible right now, very believable, pain is really our friend. No, it's really and true. It cuts through the bullshit, man. because you can have all kinds of philosophies, you know. Everything is one. All is one. You know, you're sitting in your lawn chair, sunny day, you know, beautiful. You come and you sit on the cushion at Sesshin, 3 hours into the Sesshin, it's like, you know, this is hell, you know. And so what happened to all is one? So it's like all the philosophy in the world melts away before this reality, right? And this is actually such a good thing. It's so important because to me, one of the most interesting things is that you can't imagine your pain away. In other words, you know, if you're in pain, you can't say, okay, I'm back in the Virgin Islands. You know, it's you know, here comes my wife in her hat, you know, she's got the umbrella, you know, it doesn't work, you know, it doesn't work. It just, pain just eats right through that, right? And that's fascinating to me. Imagination is no help, very feeble in responding to this. You need to enter deep samadhi. You need to enter deep samadhi. And this is like calling on your true self for help, you know. And you might say, well, help hasn't come so far, but it will come, you know. But whether it comes today or it comes in a year, the important thing is that you're being true to your true self. You might not know why your true self has done this to you, you know. But you're being true. And that happens to me all the time. You know, the other day I said, true self lets me down. I didn't really quite mean it that way. True self has plans for me that are more interesting than the ones I developed. And sometimes, you know, I make my decisions by sitting on the cushion and emptying myself out until my heart is clear and I know what to do. And sometimes those are really strange decisions, you know, and I think, why, you know, why? Okay, you know, but I feel good about it. It's like, this is what I know I have to do, and the results don't matter. See, I'm being true to my true self. See, so, you know, all of us are like artists, you know. Something said, you've got to do it. And we came and we did it. You know, and results, some people answer their koans today and some people will answer them next time or the next time. But really and truly, if you think about whether you answered your koan or how many ecstatic experiences you had or whether, you know, any breakthroughs were achieved, you're really, you're setting yourself, you're creating new obstacles for yourself. More important is this idea of living the true life by serving your true self. See, and you this feeling, you know, of the feeling of being deeply connected, you know, deep, when we sit, we get off the cushion, everything seems alive. We're so connected, you know. Even though we had pain, we're so connected. See? So that feeling of connection, of deep connection, this is the sign where our footsteps are turned in the right direction. We're being true to our true self, even if we didn't answer the call. So, this brings us to this koan. Bodhidharma came from India to China, and he brought Zen, and I started the last part of the talk with this figure. And he was unsuccessful at interesting the emperor of China in Zen meditation practice. He met with the emperor. They had a disastrous interview. The emperor didn't understand Bodhidharma. And Bodhidharma went up to what is now the Shaolin Temple and sat in a cave facing a wall practicing Mu meditation. Okay? And one day, a person shows up out of nowhere to become his student. And he is called the second patriarch. Okay? Eka, or Shinko. Okay? So he comes to the cave and he says, I would like you to teach me. And Bodhidharma says, no, you're not serious. I know you're not serious. You know, Bodhidharma's been sitting there for 9 years waiting for a student to show up. The student shows up. in the snow, no less. In the snow. Right? No, it is. It says it in the snow. And he says, please teach me. And, oh, go away. You're not serious. No. I guess, no, I am. Look, and he cuts off his arm and hands it to him. And he says, oh, all right. I guess you're serious. You could be serious. So okay, you could be serious. What's your problem? Shinko says, my mind is not at peace. My mind is, please help me pacify my mind. And Bodhidharma says, well, show me your mind. Since your mind's so troubling you so much, show me your mind. And then the second patriarch, so-called, second founder, sits down and tries to find his mind, right? Something that is permanent, that is always there, that's him, right? And his senses are very acute because he was somebody who actually had already practiced quite a bit of meditation in the Taoist tradition. And he says, you know, it's funny, but I can't really find a mind anywhere. You know, I really can't find my mind. When I try to lay hold of it, it doesn't seem to exist. And Bodhidharma says, well, you see, now your mind's pacified. So, I mean, this is kind of a strange little story, but quite important, because it describes the experience of liberation, you know. A few days ago, I was talking about Zen practice as involving liberation or purification on three levels. You know, and basically, I said the first level is the purification of the body. And the second level is, I think I said the purification of the mind first, because you first have to stabilize the mind. And enter a kind of focused, one-pointed awareness that leads to samadhi, and then in samadhi, a body begins to disappear. So purification of mind, purification of body, and then purification of heart, which is working through karma, you know, which is what many of you are working on today. I say, Zen practice is the purification of the mind, body, and the heart. But actually it's very interesting because when the mind is purified, it disappears. When the body is purified, it disappears. And when the heart is purified, it disappears. See, this is fascinating and really important. In other words, you know, when you begin to watch the breath, thoughts, you know, just begin to move to the margins of your consciousness, and they drift away, they come and go like clouds, and what we call mind really does disappear, really does disappear. And then at the next level, you know, when you're working with the body, sitting in pain, at some point, you know, body just begins to disappear. This is an interesting experience. Some people have come into Dokusan and said, you know, it's the most amazing thing. You know, My pain disappeared. I had almost no sensation. You know, some people have been working with purification of the heart, working through their karma. And people come into the Dokusan, have come into the Dokusan room and talked about this, you know, simply all the karma seems to have disappeared. It's like there's nothing there. I just am in this empty space and I feel so wonderful. This is what I mean by purification, is that at each level, body, mind, and heart disappear. And what happens when these things disappear is that we are connected again to the world. You know, we become connected to the world. Our body is reconnected to the world, mind is reconnected to the world, heart. The disappearance of these means we're back in unity with our true self. Because actually, body, mind, and heart do not exist. They do not exist. They're just an imaginary construct. There is really no such thing as the mind. There really is no such thing as the body. There really is no such thing as the heart. You know, and the language, just can't deal with this. But when you sit on the cushion and you experience fundamental reality, there's a kind of complete emptiness of the self. The self disappears and there's just, you walk outside, there's just the grass, screaming green grass, right? You look at the clouds, you are the clouds, right? Return home to true self. Your body, mind, and heart disappear. And interestingly, fish don't really know they're in the water, right? It must be so. I mean, I'm not a fish, so I don't know. And no research has been done that I know of. But you know, the chances are that fish don't know they're in the water. And this is a good thing for them, right? There's no reason they have to have a concept of water. If they began to have a concept of water, that could only be formed if they were out of the water, right? You know, when we're naturally when our bodies are comfortable and at ease, we don't think about our bodies. We're just in the moment, right? When our minds are at peace and at rest, we're not thinking about the destiny of mankind or something like that. When we're in our natural state, mind, body, and heart disappear. There's just pure awareness of moment. And when that happens, there's usually this tremendous sense of joy and connection. Yeah. And some of you have experienced this to some degree at this session. You know, the disappearance of body, mind, and heart. You could say purification, but the truth is really disappearance. There is no body. There is no mind. There is no heart. You know, those are all just imaginary constructs. The highest truth is this moment, you know, true self. You may have had some taste of this on the cushion at this session, and you may not have, you know. You may still say with Shinko, you know, my mind is on fire, troubled. Or you may say, my legs are on fire, it's more likely. Please have confidence in this beautiful path, and please keep making the effort you have made at this session. You know, my sincerest hope is that you will all be back, you know, and we'll have a chance to practice once again. I have been deeply impressed by the effort everyone has made. And I have found this, an amazing session. Many of you have just, I was, when I began doing Zen, I certainly didn't sit the way the beginners here have been sitting. And, you know, I've just seen such a beautiful, open-hearted practice. And it makes me feel, it makes me have to do a lot of zazen, not to worry about it, right? Because I feel, gee, you know, I have to do my best to be worthy of the effort all of you have made. And, you know, like anybody else, I say, gee, I hope I don't screw up, you know. And I sit on the cushion and body, mind, and heart disappear. And then I think, well, if I say the wrong thing, it's the fault of my big self. You know, I made my best effort, you know, I did my best. So, and, you know, if you are in pain today, at least you didn't have to cut off your arm, right? Bodhidharma sat facing the wall. The second patriarch stood in the snow. He cut off his arm and presented it to Bodhidharma, crying, "My mind is not at peace. I beg you, please put my mind at peace." Bodhidharma said, "Show me your mind. I search for it, but I can't take hold of it." "Now you're free," said Bodhidharma. Disappeared. Mumon's comment, that broken-toothed old Hindu came so importantly thousands of miles over the sea. This was raising waves where there was no wind. In his last years, he induced enlightenment in his disciple, who, to make matters worse, was defective in the six roots. Why, Shasanro did not know four ideographs. Let me just say that Shasanro was a great Zen master, and he was a Dharma brother of Umo, Master Yunmen, and he was illiterate. And he didn't, you know, Chinese coins used to have four ideographs on them, one at north, south, east, and west. And he was so illiterate he couldn't even read the inscriptions on a coin. But he became deeply awake because, he became deeply awake, guess how? He hit his foot, and the pain was so bad, he became awake, right? This can happen, you know, this can happen. People have capacities that they don't know they have. And we limit ourselves because we continue to believe that this self is what it is, right? You say, this is what, I know my limits, right? I know my limits. I know what I can do. Now, I know my limits. And that is totally false. I swear to you, you don't know your limits. I swear to you. You know, and it's part of as being a good Zen student is being really stupid, right? About you knowing your limits, right? You know, that when you're a little kid, when I was a little kid, I remember my mother took the light bulb out of a lamp once. And I was fascinated by that, you know, that socket. I looked in that socket and my mother said, don't do it, you know. And I had to do it. I think I even licked my finger. You know, I licked my finger. That is a born Zen student. It's like a born to do Zen. You know, you say, there's no way I can sit. You know, one day it will happen. You'll be sitting on the cushion and you'll be thinking, ring the bell. Please ring the bell. Please ring the bell. And then the bell will ring and you go, you know, I don't have to stop. You know? And you're going to, and then you say, well, do you think I can make it to the next sit, you know, next bell? And you're going to make it to the next bell and go, my God, I did it. I never thought I could do that. That, I swear to you, if you keep going, that day will come. You know? That day will come. It's just the mind creates these barriers. This is why this illiterate monk who became a great master when he hit his foot, you know, had such an advantage because he didn't know what he couldn't do, you know. So, you know, we know a little too much about our limits. You know, but this whole Zen thing is about going beyond our limits. You know, we think if this is your first sesshin, if somebody had told you, you know, 6 months ago, you'll be getting up at 4:30 in the morning, and you'll be going to bed at 11 o'clock at night, and you'll be meditating for 10 hours a day, and you'll be in pain, seven of those, let's say. You wouldn't have believed that person, right? And if somebody said to you, and at the end, your heart will be full of joy, right? You know, right? But life is more than our expectations, right? Those limits are not, I swear to you, those limits are not real. So the lesson of this little story is, you don't have to cut off your arm, but be true to, you know, have trust. Trust your true self. Something brought you here. Something put you on the cushion. You know, you see people in this Zendo who don't move for three sits. They don't move a muscle. How do you think they do it? See, do you think they're tougher than you are? You know? Because, you know, you'll see big, strong guys in the Zendo whose arms are bigger than my leg, you know, and they move. And, you know, I used to practice, my teachers, Webb and Genki Roshi, were both, you know, like, I think they were both under 5'5", you know, and both kind of scrawny little guys, you know, and they never moved. So it's not toughness, right? It's not like you're going to tough it out. You're going to be a powerhouse, right? That's not what this is about, right? You know, it's not the toughest guy in the room. It's allowing, being true to your true, let your true self take over. The true self brought you here. Let the true self help you. Let the true self help you. You might not be, the real problem is you don't believe it will happen. But soon, and that's the real source of your pain. You don't believe it will happen. But sooner or later, it will happen, and you'll be amazed. So just hang in there. You know, it will happen to you. There's nothing called a talent for Zen. There's nobody who has a knack. The people who sit here sit after sit, unmoving, didn't start that way. You know, they started being, just like everybody else, sitting through 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, 25 minutes, wiping the sweat off their brows, right? You know, so just trust in the self that brought you here, and you will not be disappointed.